If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now it's the final days of our Everything's on Sale event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses. Our Memorial Day event ends Monday. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.
Merkle Media.
Everybody, this is Joel Thomas, and this is Free the Rabbits. And how are all the free range rabbits doing out there today? First, I want to say thanks to everybody who's been giving 5-star reviews across the board on all the platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other of your favorite podcast streaming apps. I just want to say thank you so much. You have helped the show grow so much in just a little over half of a year, and it's been an amazing ride so far, and I look for an even longer journey with all of you. If you're a follower of the show and you haven't given a 5-star review, please go give a 5-star review on whatever platform you're on right now. And if you're new here, wait till you listen to the show, and if you liked it, then go give a 5-star review. I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. And for the people that have been asking, how can I donate to the show to help the show grow financially? There's a couple ways you can do it. You can go to YouTube. You can become a member there. There's several different tiers. Also, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/freetherabbits, and you can give a one-time donation, or you can set up a new monthly donation if you'd like to donate monthly. I appreciate everything you guys are doing for the show. Now let's get into it. What's up, guys? We're back with another episode of Free the Rabbits, and I've got another 2-time guest on the show. I just had Cryptids on the Corn on the show as their first 2-time guest, and now I've got John from 21CD Podcast back on the show. And this whole episode we're about to give you today started from just something John said in a meeting that we had about a new film that we're about to go shoot. And I'll let everybody know it's about the Beast of Bray Road. We're actually going to be out there and staying on the property for a week among some other places close by in the area. And John's going to be part of this film. This will be his second film he's a part of us with. We're pretty excited about it. But while we're having this meeting, John just randomly throws out this crazy theory / reality that I'd never heard of. And I'm like, what is that? So I let it matriculate for a little bit. I think I texted you about an hour later and I was like, hey man, I'm not trying to step on your toes if you're already going to do an episode on this on your show, but you want to do an episode about man corn, which is the wildest thing ever. Get ready, y'all. We're doing an episode about corn today. Literal corn.
Literal corn.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to talk about corn for a while. And I'm from Wisconsin, so I have a lot of corn knowledge. And so I'm really excited to do this. And yeah, I honestly didn't. It was kind of like I was thankful that you requested to do the show, because there's no way I was going to sit here by myself and talk about corn for an hour and a half, not knowing if anybody is still listening. So at least we get to go through this together. But no, it is pretty cool. And before everybody tunes out, I'll just go ahead and let you know, corn may or may not be responsible for cannibalism. So that's where we're going.
Yeah, and we got to listen, a lot of good evidence on this whole subject. And as a matter of fact, because when I first heard it, it's so out there that I'm like, well, it's got to be something to it, right? And you were like, yeah, there's this book. It's called Man Corn. It's by Christy Turner. And check it out, man. So I was actually online and I found it as a PDF. It was just sitting out there. And I'm like, oh, here we go. Because I went to Amazon and a couple other places. And man, they were jacking the price up on that thing. I'm like, I don't know if I feel comfortable. Don't get me wrong, I've spent some money on books before. But I didn't really want to do that.
It's a very niche topic to spend like $60 or $80 on a book for.
Exactly.
Like if you're going to spend $60 to $80 on a book, maybe not about corn unless you're like super passionate. But yeah, I mean, it's like a 600-page book or something, right? Like I'm not going to lie, I didn't read all 600 pages of it, but it does contain a lot of really interesting ideas about how scientifically, chemically, it appears that the human body doesn't really handle corn that well. And because of that, upon its consumption, there are chemical reactions which lead to some interesting results. And so the idea is, and some scientists put this together. This isn't just me or anybody that I know just putting this together, but a maize-heavy diet leads to essentially low serotonin synthesis. And lower serotonin synthesis leads to generally increased aggression, religious fervor, and all that kind of stuff. And so these North American tribes, the cradle of civilization, if you want to call it that, on this side of the planet over here, they had a very maize heavy diet. This is where maize originated, was in the Americas. And because of that, it's a theory that is why there was so much cannibalism in the Americas. So there we go.
Yeah, you're completely right with that. And we'll definitely get into today some of the studies that were done. We're going to talk about hamsters today, too. So get ready, yeah, guys. It's going to be corn and hamsters and Native Americans. But it's going to be a lot of interesting stuff. I'm going to preface this with, we're not trying to fearmonger. So if you're eating corn tonight, relax. You're going to be okay. There's just some great scientific evidence. And to bounce off what you just said, a primarily maize-heavy diet. We're talking, you're eating this constantly and you're not implementing anything else into your diet. And that's what's going to cause this. And we'll talk about one of the test studies they did with hamsters, and also what happened with some of the Spanish people who were coming over here looking for all kinds of things and did some pretty sordid things as well. But they were bringing corn back to the Europeans, and some things were happening with them too. So it's very interesting. And then we're obviously going to talk about the Anasazi, because that's going to be a huge part of this, and what their connection is to corn and cannibalism as well. And I know it's a very touchy subject for some people when it comes to the Anasazi. And we'll talk about some of those things too. I want to say this.
I'm always very balanced on this show. At least I try to be. And I don't target anybody specifically. But at the same time, I do try to present truth. And when there's tons of research on certain topics and a lot of people have looked into certain things and there's a lot of evidence for it, you have to present it. But I will say this, any group of people on the planet, ancestors have done evil things. So it's not one particular type of people. And I know there's a contingent of some of them are Native Americans, but just a contingent of people out there that refuse to believe that there was any kind of cannibalism going on with some of these tribes because they think that that's what the Spanish were saying to use as a catalyst to attack them. Now, there was some of that going on where the Spanish were making up things about some of the Indian tribes here to use it as a reason to weaponize against them. But there's also a twofold part of it. Not everything they were saying wasn't true either. So there were things that were being said by the Spanish that they saw that these tribes were doing that weren't good. So two things can be true at the same time. You can have two sides doing evil things and it worked out the way it did. So I think,
yeah. And I mean, whenever you have something like that, I mean, it was a genocide. So like whenever you have an invading country come into another land and commit genocide, unfortunately that people, especially in that time frame, that people's story is only going to be told by what's left. And a lot of the things that the Spaniards did involved the erasal of history that belonged to the peoples they conquered. Because one very important thing to realize is the Spaniards were incredibly Catholic at that time. So when they come over here, South America, and they start seeing all these people who are clearly worshiping serpents, clearly worshiping all of these really bizarre gods. And, you know, we look at it from a long distance away through the eyes of retold stories countless times. But imagine what they must have seen, like in the flesh, like the Aztec kingdom or the Mayan kingdom in its full glory, the people by the thousands, all those pyramids painted up and probably kites and balloons in the sky, maybe even. And, they see this magical, this is the way that I read it by somebody's account. I can't remember now. It was some guy from several hundred years ago. And, he describes it as sort of magical, where you go there and you almost can't believe what you're seeing. And from a Catholic point of view, if what is not Catholic appears to be better than, you know, Catholicism in that day, I'm not crucifying any Catholics out there today, but in that day, you know, when it was very militarized and the church was very much, let's expand. That's what the Catholics are going to do. It's what the Portuguese did. It's what the English did. It's what we all did.
But absolutely.
But yes, to your point, I definitely do, because I am going to be talking about several other Native American tribes, and I know that we both have a very broad audience. So like, I do want to make my point known too. I'm by no means trying to fit anybody into the box of cannibal. I'm only going off of information that I've read, and I am always willing to change my mind if alternative evidence comes forth. And I also don't judge a past people or a present people by the sins of their ancestors either. So, I know one of the tribes that I'm going to be talking about is the Tonkawa. And even as they're a North American tribe, and even as early as last year, they were still getting, this sort of hatred from the Cherokee and the Apache people because of the cannibalism that the Tonkawa ancestors had committed hundreds of years ago. So guys, I'm not here to judge anybody. I'm a sinner just like the rest of us.
And to your point too, when it comes to specifically the Anasazi, a lot of the, I guess, hate would be coming from people from other tribes, other Native American tribes. Actually, we'll definitely talk about that today too. It's not just the quote unquote white man either. Right. So there's a lot of disparity between Native American tribes about the past too. And I think that we have to showcase that. But I will say this, after going through Mancorn and seeing the evidence there, what's interesting about that book, it got a lot of pushback when it came out. A lot of mainstream, and that's when I start really, my spidey sense goes off, when a lot of mainstream people who are in the same field of archaeology or any of these paleontology, any of these different groups, when they're all against something and they come at it with a lot of fervor, then I start looking into that thing and saying, well, this might have more to it. And man, I'm telling you, you talk about thorough. Christy Turner and his wife, they were freaking thorough, man. I mean, they went and studied these bones. We're going to talk today about the different signs that they map out. There's a 12 sign, and then there's like a shorter one. And they show you in these steps how that you know by looking at these bones whether they were a product of cannibalism. I mean, they were in it. And they have a map, which I'll show today on the screen, of all the different areas that the Anasazi were at, where they found all of these bones that were the product of cannibalism. And we're talking about a lot, too. It wasn't just a small amount. And again, the book's massive. And it's, I mean, chapter 3 itself, I think, is half the book. Because it was literally just them starting with the first archaeological site where bones that were the product of cannibalism were found, all the way to the last ones. And they went to all these sites and they found bones and they studied them. And they said, yes, they absolutely are the product of this. And it wasn't because of climate change. It wasn't because it was too cold and they had to do it, because they went to areas where there are other Native American tribes who were in colder regions and there were no bones like that there. So they are showcasing that this Anasazi tribe was bloodthirsty. They were violent. And this is coming not just from these archaeologists, man. This is also from these other tribes, like people from all these other tribes, like the Hopi tribe and some of these other ones. They talk specifically about the Anasazi and how that they were super violent. And I just think there's too much evidence to say that they weren't doing it. But again, this isn't judging somebody that is of that ancestry now from what those people did in the past. Like, I never look at anybody like that. I never look at somebody of any social class or race and look at them with any kind of disrespect because of something in the past. I think that's ludicrous. And I think that goes from any perspective you look at, from any race. We should never do that to each other. So I did want to preface that to start out before we jump right into it, so people understand that this is just research and it's legitimate research. I mean, these are guys who have done, you know, years and years and years of this to be able to put together and compile something and showcase it in a way that this happened. It's a part of history.
Yeah, it's essentially what you could categorize as almost forbidden archaeology, really, because it just kind of goes against the narrative that is supposed to be being told today. And the narrative that's supposed to be being told is, you know, white man bad. And so anything that ever happened here to the tribes is must have been our cause. But what, you know, people forget that there were over 500 tribes in North America. Like not all at once, but throughout time, 500 tribes. And a lot of these tribes did not, I mean, I think maybe the Anasazi were actually the pinnacle of civilizations in North America, maybe only overshadowed slightly by the Cahokia, but they were also working together a lot because the Cahokia had the Great Lakes and we know the Anasazi were mining copper. And so there's a pretty good, idea that they were probably at least trading. But the Anasazi, for people who don't know, they're extremely, because they're just now starting to come back into the limelight. But like, I feel like archaeology has largely wanted to forget about the Anasazi for a very long time, even though we don't have any ruins in the country that are more prominent than the Anasazi ruins. Their great houses that they had with their portal, what do they call the, I forget what they call the circle things in the ground. They essentially would call gods, according to their records, to these great houses where hundreds of people would live. And they would then, engage in a little bit of ritual sacrifice and cannibalism. But one of the things that I've always thought was interesting was that I'm pretty sure the Anasazi are descendants of the Aztecs. And if that's the case, the Anasazi have a much longer history than we're even giving them credit for, because they go all the way back to arguably the origin of cannibalism in the Americas.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you were just talking about gods, and I definitely want to explore some of that part of it, because it's important to know, you know, who they're worshiping, why they were worshiping, who they were worshiping. And we also want to tie corn into all this too, because corn's a huge part of this. And what that could have also been doing to someone's diet, who's not only eating a maize heavy diet, but then is mixing human flesh in with the maize. And we'll talk about what some of that is too. But I did want to start in a random spot, because it's going to sound strange to start in this place, but I do want to start with some apocryphal text to kind of set the basis for where we're kind of leaning with this corn thing and where corn may have actually come from. Now, we know that genetic modification is happening on a grand scale globally now. We know that. This isn't something that's a conspiracy theory. This is just a fact. This is mainstream knowledge at this point. This goes all the way from plants, food, to animals, and now even humans that they're creating in labs. So this is nothing new, but I believe that the start of all this started in the ancient past. And I know that you and I think very similarly about the time before Noah. I believe that technology was just as crazy as it is now, if not further along, but maybe in a different way. You know, I always say that it might not have operated the way we think of technology now. It could have been a completely different type of technology, but I do think it was great. And I do think that genetic modifications were going on back then. We know that chimeras existed, at least in all these mythologies. We know that giants existed in all these mythologies. So to really hone in on genetic modification, I think we have to go back to, we'll start with the Book of Enoch, chapter 7. And I'll read a little bit of that. Verse 1, "And all the others together with them took unto themselves wives, and these are the watchers. And each chose for himself one. They begin to go in unto them and to defile themselves with them. And they taught them charms, enchantments, the cutting of roots, and made them acquainted with plants." So this is the part where they are corrupting not only animal kind, not only humankind. They're creating these Nephilim, these chimera, but they're also corrupting the plant life. They're corrupting all of creation. And I do think that there is the possibility, as we're theorizing a little bit today, that corn could be a byproduct of some sort of genetic modification. We know they're genetically modifying it now. We know they genetically modify all kinds of food right now. So maybe it's further along than it was back then, or maybe back then it was further along. We're trying to get it back to that now. I don't know. But we do know that the watchers were teaching mankind how to genetically modify not only the living beings on Earth, but also plant life as well.
Absolutely. And not only, well, I mean, to your point, the Mayan people who actually worshipped corn as almost a god, they had a goddess that they attributed the power of corn to, or that gave power to corn. But they had multiple phases for her face that they would paint or carve. based on the stages that the corn was in. So this goddess, she would have her face carved on their stone walls or their tablets or whatever, based on how, what season the corn was in, how they were bending it to make it grow better, and then how they would preserve it and how they would prepare it as well. Because it's almost like they knew at one point that corn wasn't really good for us the way it is. And so the Maya actually developed this very intricate way of processing it because it was more hazardous to them than it was, you know, when they were eating it. And we also nowadays eat a version of corn that is in no way the caliber of the corn that was being eaten back then, because we also have extremely genetically modified vegetables, especially in the West. And all of our stuff is, I mean, you can't even call it, you can hardly call it a version of the vegetable that it once was. So I consider maize and corn completely different, because I think most people attribute corn to what they buy on the cob, whereas maize, I factor is more of like this god grain that came in the past. And it's very interesting that you mentioned that verse, because I actually had a whole write-up on that. And it actually even talks about jubilees a little bit, which I know is kind of controversial. But there's this really interesting idea that, I mean, I thought it was interesting when it came to me when I was researching it. And people forget that humanity essentially caused all the problems on Earth to reach the point of destruction time and time again. Obviously, the Watchers manipulated us and Satan and all that kind of stuff. But in the end, God didn't smite the earth to get back at the bad angels. He did it because humanity became way too insane. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot of record on how we became too insane before the flood. So my question was, what exactly were they doing back then that the land was so depraved that everything had to be smited? What exactly were the Watchers and the Nephilim doing to us? And I think that's kind of the question most people ask. But my question became, what were we actually doing that was so bad? And when you analyze the Bible on cannibalism, it definitely seems like the life is in the blood, and consuming the blood is a mega no-no. Maybe one of the biggest no-nos in the Bible, because it does seem to say, I am of the Nephilim. I am of their kind. And so my idea, to go along with yours, is that at some point after the flood, people began to populate South America. And in that time, perhaps the Watchers, perhaps the Nephilim, whoever it is, you know, I know there's some fogginess about what happened after the flood, where they came from, what they became. Some people think they were inside the earth. Some people think they were spirits, whatever the case.
Some people think they were hanging off the ark.
right. Yeah. I at one point mentioned the imposter theory on my podcast about how maybe there was a skinwalker or something on the ark, and that did not go over well. But but my point is, these fallen ones had to get access somehow to humanity on the other side, and they had to establish their power over here in the Americas. And I think they did it through the gift of maize, because this is where maize comes from. It didn't come from the Middle East. God doesn't seem to really mention corn at all anywhere, nor do any of his prophets, any of his people. They talk about grains, but it's not corn. So corn came from somewhere completely different, or he just didn't want us to discover it until the people in South America discovered it. You know, I don't know. Nobody really seems to know the answer.
Man, I am really glad you brought up jubilees, because that's exactly where I was about to go. So I was already on it, man.
There you go, bro.
When I'm looking at these apocryphal texts, I had to go to jubilees because jubilees was already alluding to a lot of this too. And I've got a really interesting tie into Quetzalcoatl, the god that the Aztecs worshipped, and subsequently the Anasazi and a lot of different tribes, right? But this particular god is, depending on what you look at, right? Some people think Elohim, that one of the smaller G gods. Some people think it was a fallen angel, a seraphim, because of the, you know, flying serpent imagery, because seraphim are said to be very serpentine like. So that's a possibility as well. You know, I'm very open to whatever. Let's just say at the base level, we know that Quetzalcoatl was a god that people worshiped. Now, what it actually was that was masquerading as this god, that's up for debate. And, you know, people can debate all day long about it. And I'd say maybe you're right, because I don't have the answer to that, right? But Jubilees chapter 5, verse 1, "And it came to pass when the children of men began to multiply on the face of the earth and their daughters were born unto them, the angels of God saw them on a certain year of this Jubilee, that they were beautiful to look upon. And they took themselves wives of all whom they chose, and they bare unto them sons, and they were giants. And lawlessness increased on the earth, and all flesh corrupted its way, alike men, cattle, and beasts, and birds, and everything that walks the earth, all of them corrupted their ways and orders. And they began to devour each other, and lawlessness increased on the earth, and every imagination of the thoughts of all men, thus evil continually." So this is just letting you know, anything living is being corrupted. And this is before the flood. Now, you just mentioned after the flood, because things get bad again, right? So Jubilee specifically actually talks about this in chapter 10. And this starts in verse 1. "And in the third week, this Jubilee, the unclean demons begin to lead astray the children of the sons of Noah and to make air and destroy them." So these demons are the spirits of the Nephilim that died during the flood. "And the sons of Noah came to Noah, their father, and they told him concerning the demons which were leading astray and blinding and slaying his son's son." So obviously at this point, there are quite a few people back on the earth now, and they've been repopulating. And at this point, these Nephilim spirits are agitating people and causing them to get stirred up. So Noah goes to God and he says, "Listen, you saved us from the flood. I really don't want to go through this again." You know, he even says, "Let thy grace lift upon my sons and let not wicked spirits rule over them, lest they should destroy them from the earth." Now, it gets really interesting right here, because there is a entity that pops up in this text called Mastema. Now, Mastema is the chief of the spirits, and from all indications, this is a fallen angel, and goes to the Lord because Noah's asking God to wipe him out. Now, you may ask, and I know there's people that aren't Christians and people that don't believe in the Bible, and this is why they don't believe in the Bible, because they always say that God's evil or God causes whatever or Yahweh's evil. And I'm not going down that debate, because I did a 2-hour episode on that and stirred half of the crowd up when I was talking about that Yahweh's not evil. But believe what you want to believe. That's besides the point. But what I'm trying to get to is God allows free will. That's why he allows there to be evil, because if he just wiped out evil, there's no free will. We don't have free will anymore. We're just mindless drones, robots that are doing whatever he wants us to do. So Mastema goes to him and says, "Lord Creator, let some of them remain before me." So he's saying, don't lock them all up. Don't lock up all these Nephilim spirits. Leave some for me, and let them hearken to my voice and do all that I shall say unto them. For if some of them are not left to me, I shall not be able to execute the power of my will on the sons of men, for these are for corruption and leading astray before my judgment. For great is the wickedness of the sons of men. So interestingly enough, if you tie this into the Bible and you look at how different texts line up, Mastema seems to be the angel of death, or some people consider like Samael to be the angel of death. Maybe they're one and the same. Maybe that's just another name, but this would be considered the angel of Yahweh. So a lot of times people will pull out these texts without understanding Hebrew, and they'll say, well, Yahweh's doing these evil things. No, that's not what's happening here. There's an angel of Yahweh, this angel of judgment, that does things to people because of people's sin, right? So this is this angel. This is this Mastema from all indications. But here's not a good entity. not a good entity at all, but he asked God to leave 1/10 or the 10th part of these Nephilim spirits. And God says he will. God says, I will leave these Nephilim spirits just this amount so that man can be tested, right? So I think that's where people don't understand either is as Christians or just people who have the divine spark in us because we're created like God, that we're supposed to be tested. We're supposed to be tested with sin. Job was tested by this particular entity from all indications. Satan himself went before God and asked to take everything away from Job because he knew that he would curse him, and he didn't. So there are tests that are involved as a part of our life. So God agrees on it, and Mastema has these other Nephilim spirits with him. Now, this was really wild, man, and I don't know how I haven't caught this before reading Jubilees, but this gave me a different perspective about angel kind in general, because we typically think about, specifically with the Book of Enoch, that angels came and traded with us occulted knowledges for access to women to be able to create these Nephilim. But we've never really given the credence to the fact that angels were always created to be emissaries for us to God. They're literally in the Hebrew, the words malakim, and it means to essentially be a helper to us, is what it's called. And that part of it made me think that, why are we just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, thinking that angels, good angels, didn't also teach mankind who were following God things from the correct order of how God would want us to know? It's not that they're corrupting anything that God has given us like these fallen angels did, but this is a whole different aspect of it. And they talk about this in Jubilees, which is really wild here. So after Mastema is allowed to have these 10th of these angels, of these Nephilim spirits, and one of us, and I dug into some Hebrew text, and this one of us is Raphael from all indications. So one of us, he commanded that we should teach Noah all their medicines, for he knew that they would not walk in uprightness nor strive in righteousness. And we did according to all his words. All the malignant evil ones we bound in the place of condemnation, and a tenth part of them we left that they might be subject before Satan on the earth. And we explained to Noah all the medicines of their diseases together with their seductions. Now he might heal them with herbs of the earth. So we have this whole other part where Raphael and these angels are teaching Noah how to use the herbs correctly, how to heal with these herbs too. So we've got these two juxtapositions going on. Now, you may wonder, like, well, how does this tie into corn and how does this tie into Quetzalcoatl? Well, it's interesting because Mastema has a lot of traits that are similar to Quetzalcoatl. And the name means hatred, hostility, enmity, persecution. He's a leader of hosts of demons. So from, you know, all indications, Quetzalcoatl is a Elohim, is a top elite level god who is, you know, all these other gods bow before this god. You know what I mean? So if we're looking at it from that aspect, because some people have even suggested that Quetzalcoatl was Satan himself, and I've heard that argument too. But I would go maybe a little different direction and say maybe a fallen entity like this Mastema could be an incarnation of this being called Quetzalcoatl, or at least maybe one of the first names, because I believe these entities change names throughout history as they go. They just fit in where they can, and they just rebrand. So I'm questioning that, as these entities after the flood are doing their best to re-corrupt again, is this mastema Quetzalcoatl? Is he a version of Quetzalcoatl? Is it something in that line of thinking? I don't know. This is me theorizing, but at the same time, I think there's at least some idea that it's a possibility.
Yeah. I think I said this on my own show the other day too. Like I'm fairly sure, like as sure as anybody could be about anything, that like Quetzalcoatl is a little bit more than just a fake god that, you know, the Aztecs invented. But and also the Aztecs were sort of they weren't the last of these great empires in South America, but they had already inherited all of these gods from their ancestors who were here thousands of years before they were. The Maya and the Aztec, you know, obviously they came probably about 4,000 years after what we would call the cradle of civilization coming to birth in South America. And I think that the way these watchers kind of work is kind of like water on time. And so they kind of like, sometimes the water's low, sometimes the water's high. They ride the tide. And there was something about the age of the Aztecs that this watcher, this fallen one, was just like, now's my time, buddy, and came in the form of Quetzalcoatl. That's what I really think happened. And I think the main reason that that happened was because look, these gods probably don't even think like we do, right? Like, I'm talking from a human mindset, but it seems like from this action, Quetzalcoatl, whatever his real name is, it seems like the purpose was really to get up into North America, like, and did that through the Anasazi. Countless Aztec tribes have stories where these giants were literally chasing them into North America. Like, they had to flee their homeland because these cannibalistic, gigantic humanoids and hybrids of other types were literally pursuing them in the forest, and they just had to get out. And, you know, some people say that the Anasazi cannibalized themselves. I still believe that there's a chance that they were cannibalized, that they were eaten. And by some of these rogue Aztecs or some of these giant tribes that were pursuing them, and their descendants later became the cliff dwellers of the American Southwest and began building their structures in the cliffs, because there must have been something way down there on the ground. So my idea is that, yeah, Quetzalcoatl probably is one of these fallen ones, and he had some great moments of glory, but he could not overcome the Spanish Empire when they came, and the Aztecs ultimately were destroyed. But, you know, obviously Mexico came to be and the Mexicans came to be and all that. But the real legacy was left there, and then sort of the rest of it snaked its way up into North America. And honestly, when you talk about Quetzalcoatl, it's important to remember they do kind of paint him as this picture of kind of a guy in robes who's coming on a boat made of snakes. And that's a very interesting painting for a god when you put it against the backdrop of the Aztec Empire, because that's not really what they dress like in the Aztec Empire. So that's an interesting visual to me too. It seems like he's a little bit out of character, and then they manipulated him into this snake, essentially. But he may have had a very different visual and just represented himself with a snake.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And it comes from the Nahuatl, and it means precious serpent or feathered serpent. But
funny how that trend just continues, man?
Yeah, it does. And in the literal sense, it means serpent of precious feathers. And allegorically, it means wisest of men. So now we're getting into the wisdom that is given from Quetzalcoatl to the Aztecs, to the Mayans, to these tribes that are around. Also, just to slide this in real quick, because we were talking about the Spanish coming over, one of the things also that the Spanish saw from several different reports were giants when they were over here as well. So they would have been freaking out just because of that too. So again, there was a there's so much more that was going on during that time period that has just been lost, that has been rewritten, has been changed. Obviously, if you dig, you know, deep enough, you can find some of this stuff and at least be able to put together a few pieces. But I believe that the Americas in general, and I mean South and North America, was a wild place back then. And I mean from the idea of all of these different Native American tribes. I believe the Moors were also here as well. And I think there were giant tribes. So I think you've got just a melting pot, kind of what America is now. Interestingly enough, it's a melting pot of all these different things. And I think we're kind of starting to push towards that crescendo again of just a lot of evil. And I think that that's also what was going on. And I think there's been several resets throughout history. And I think that that's what happened there. There was just another reset that happened and it kind of cleared things out. And now we're kind of building and amping back up to another type of reset or what they want to be a reset.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now it's the final days of our Everything's on Sale event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses. Our Memorial Day event ends Monday. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.
Yeah, I mean, if you're like me, like you kind of figure that resets are mainly because of how powerful humanity is getting. There's something about resets and the mental and physical power of humanity that go hand in hand. And so I did an episode about how I believe that the Aztecs actually had the ability to fly. I think they had actual machines and may have even had electricity of some sort of type. I'm not sure how they used it or anything like that. I just, some of the stuff that I've seen seems to be sort of representative of the use of electricity. And if that kind of stuff was here in the Aztec Empire, in the Mayan Empire, and the Spaniards saw that, then yeah, that would be a great reason for a reset because they could be too dangerous. One of the reasons that one of the main reasons that any of these peoples were completely smited was because they were too nice to the Spaniards. They welcomed the Spaniards in many cases. That's how the Mayans were completely obliterated in almost a single day, was because when they were in the middle of a civil war, the Spaniards showed up to the winning side and said, hey, we'll go ahead and help you and be your buddy and everything. And so they welcomed them in. And then next thing you know, they just annihilated everybody. No more Mayan Empire. And it does make you wonder if the Aztecs knew what was coming, would it have been a completely different story? If they wouldn't have had that soft spot for foreigners, would it have been a completely different story? Would they have been able to be much more than they are today? And what would North America be then?
What do you think about this? And I've thought about this before, because Quetzalcoatl is said to have been a shining one. That's another descriptor of who Quetzalcoatl was. And he was said to have white skin and, you know, glowing. And do you think that, one, we know these entities are all about warfare and destruction. And do you think that because these white men come over and they're already in contact with this Quetzalcoatl, who's, you know, a shining one, do you think that that may have been one reason why that they were so allowing and with open arms when they came here? And maybe even these gods were encouraging it, because I believe that these gods have nothing good planned for us. And I think that they would allow full civilizations to be destroyed because you're destroying God's creation at that point. So I'm just curious about that thought pattern, because I know there's a general correlation between some of these shining ones and then when typically white people show up and they're already in contact with something that is similar in nature, at least, you know, from a visual standpoint.
Well, yeah. And I mean, according to, I mean, seems like every tribe has a story or another of how they were betrayed by the white man. But when we come, according to this modern narrative that we've been led to believe, as true as it may be, whatever, the idea is that the white man, the European, came over and was just so many leagues above the savages that were here. We had our ships, we had our armor, we had our firepower, our stuff was made of metal that they didn't even have. Like, it was all that kind of stuff. And these ships probably looked absolutely insane to them. And so, yeah, they definitely thought we were of the European, was of the gods. And they talk about that in great detail. Almost, you know, most tribes talk about how when the white man showed up, they appeared as gods. They were just so many leagues above what just the technology had developed so far compared to these native tribes here. But I don't believe that narrative, for the record. I don't believe that they were so many leagues above the Aztecs. I think the Aztecs were far more technological, and the Maya, and they didn't know what to expect. They got caught, you know, with their pants down. And it's just too bad, because it led to the extermination of an empire. But you're right. Like, the god Quetzalcoatl or whoever it is, he doesn't care that the Aztecs fall. He loves it. He loves death, right? Like, that's what it's all about. So if I can lead these people to their death, then certainly I will. And that's how I get power. There's always going to be more people.
Mm. That's interesting, man. And I've got a little interesting tidbit before we jump, you know, deep into the corn here in a second, since we've kind of set the basis for where we're going.
We should
going
have had cryptids in the corn on this too.
I know, right?
Cryptids of the corn would be sick on this one.
I know, man. Yeah, as a matter of fact, because Justin knows a ton about corn. I've talked to him about it. Yeah, he grew up on a farm, so he knows a lot about corn. funny enough, like, he's a biologist and he knows so much about animals, but you start talking to him about plants and all that, man, he knows a lot. I was actually shocked at how much he knew. And I was like, man, you just know a lot about a lot. And he's like, yeah, man, when it comes to plants and animals, he's like, I just love talking about it. So, but they're
great guys, man.
Oh, they're great. They're some of my favorite people. So I found this really interesting tidbit, and I just did an episode on Joseph Smith and his link to Aleister Crowley. And as I'm digging through all this, and I'm literally digging through stuff about Quetzalcoatl, I find this crazy narrative that comes out of nowhere. So there's this guy, John Taylor. And he was an English-born religious leader, and he served as the third president of the Church of the Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from 1880 to 1887. He is the first and so far the only president of the LDS Church to have been born outside the United States. Now, in 1892, he writes, super interesting here, the story of the life of the Mexican divinity, Quetzalcoatl, closely resembles that of the Savior. So closely, indeed, that we can come to no other conclusion that Quetzalcoatl and Christ, Jesus, are the same being. But the history of the former has been handed down to us through an impure Lamontish source, which is one of the four tribes that they talk about, like the Nephites, which has sadly disfigured and perverted the original incidents and teachings of the Savior's life and ministry. This is from Mediation and Atonement, page 194. This is just for the inevitable Mormons who get angry when I start pointing out things that the people in their church have written and talked about. And you've got a guy who is the president of the LDS Church who said that Quetzalcoatl, who is literally a evil deity, that he attributes Jesus or the Christ, which obviously when you use Christ, you can put that umbrella over a lot. Christ is the same being. So this goes back into this entire occult nature of the LDS Church. But I found that fascinating that they would consider Quetzalcoatl as the savior, that this being, this entity is who they pray to. Wild stuff, man.
Is that the perspective that he was? So he thinks.
I read his exact words. What I just wrote was read was actual quote.
That is crazy. So
from Mediation and Atonement. So if you look up Mediation and Atonement, page 194, this is what he said about Quetzalcoatl.
So is Quetzalcoatl, does that mean that like he's, what do you think? Do you think that means that he's kind of like, according to him, just a version of Christ or an imposter?
No, he believes that. He thinks that the narrative that's said about Quetzalcoatl now, about him being an evil deity, is wrong. That he was always a good deity.
Oh, man.
When you do actual research, and I tell people this all the time, you unravel so many things that you never thought you would. And, you know, I got into a little bit of a back and forth with somebody who was not happy that, you know, I did an episode about Yahweh not being evil. And I explained to that person that I came from a Gnostic background. I came from a cult background. That's my background. I had tons of Gnostic text. I understood them thoroughly. So I understand what you think it is. The problem is, what I found was with a lot of Gnosticism is they cherry pick verses out of the Bible to fit their narrative. All of these Gnostic sects throughout history did that. They would pull these texts out, and then they wouldn't even look at the original translations of the Hebrew or the Koine Greek to understand in connection with the context of what it actually means. It's very similar with stuff going on in the LDS Church. You could ask any Mormon right now, and they would not know what I just told you. But it's a fact. It's not something that I'm making up. This is something that's in the writings of one of their presidents. So you have to ask the question, why are these people who are at the upper echelons of these different societies and religions, why are they always leaning towards this narrative that just seems like, man, y'all are worshiping a bunch of fallen entities?
Yeah, it's pretty weird. Especially since, you know, the Aztec civilization did not predate Christ. So it also just seems to like showcase a lack of understanding of scripture, in my opinion. Just basic timeline stuff doesn't seem to, I just wouldn't expect Christ to come back like that. That's obviously not, we know when he's, we don't know when, but we know that the next time he comes back is going to be the time that he returns. And so it's not like he's going to come in the form of a snake, and then he's going to come in the form of a bird, and then finally he's going to come on this day, and now everything's good. So like, it's just kind of a weird idea to even develop.
Yeah. But, and I believe that the point he's making is because, you know, Native American culture is all wrapped into the Book of Mormon and just Mormonism in general. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to say that this Quetzalcoatl entity is actually Christ, and it was all misinterpreted. Everything we know about Quetzalcoatl now is just all misinterpretation. He was a good guy.
You know what that sounds like, dude? You know what that sounds like? That sounds like how Santa Claus was invented or something like that. You know, like that sounds like the Catholics had to do something to like make this right in their eyes. And then it just sort of spiraled out of control from there. We have to kill this God. This isn't Quetzalcoatl. This is Jesus Christ. And then from there, it was just over.
Yeah. I thought that was super wild. And I had to throw that out there because that's just such a bizarre thing that I ran across. But we're going to shift into the corn part of this. And I want to talk about the hamsters becoming cannibals because this is such a interesting
Dude, everything I saw in the hamsters was against my will. And I saw some stuff I did not want to see.
I didn't look at anything. That's the thing. I just did the research, the reading. I don't want to see all that.
I was like, what is this? I clicked a video. Dang it. I can't get that out.
Yeah. John's not eating corn again for like 5 years.
Yeah, and I'm not getting a hamster either. But yeah, tell me what you know, because I basically saw the video and I was like, okay, that happens, and that's where I stopped.
Yeah, so there was a conservation biologist at the University of Strasbourg, Mathilde Tissier, and they had all these female hamsters that they had bred, and they had them in these cages, right? And they're watching them, and they're really active, like overly active, and they don't really understand why, and they're really getting aggressive. So she remembers seeing newly born pups spread around the cages while the mothers ran about. Then the mother hamsters would take their pups, put them in piles of corn they had stored in the cage, and eat their babies alive with the corn.
As like, so a dressing. Said,
I know, dude. It's freaking wild. I had some really bad moments, she says. I'm sure you did. I thought I had done something wrong. Probably. So they begin to experiment feeding the hamsters wheat or corn in the lab with either clover or earthworms to better reflect the animal's normal omnivorous diets. We thought the diets would create some nutritional deficiencies. But instead, Tissier and her colleagues saw something very different. All the female hamsters were able to successfully reproduce, but those fed corn showed abnormal behaviors before giving birth. Then they gave birth outside their nest and mostly ate their young on the first day after birth. So the ones that were eating the corn and the maize were just tearing the pups up as soon as they were. But they were essentially going crazy. They were turning into like zombie hamsters. Now, when you're giving all of this maize, all of this corn, you are not taking in a specific nutrient. It's called niacin. Now, niacin is a B vitamin that's made and used by your body to turn food into energy. It helps keep your nervous system, digestive system, and skin healthy. Niacin B3 is often part of a daily multivitamin, which I do take, but most people get enough niacin from the food they eat. But when you're eating a heavy corn diet, you're not getting a lot of niacin. And what it can cause, and this is what happened in the 1700s, so a disease called pellagra came out in the 1700s in Europe after corn became a dietary staple. People with pellagra experienced horrible rashes, diarrhea, and dementia. And until the disease's cause was identified in the mid-20th century, millions of people suffered and thousands died. The Mesoamericans who domesticated corn largely did not have this problem because they processed corn with a technique called nixtamalization, who essentially, it free-bound niacin in corn, and it makes it available as a nutrient. So they are saying that the Mesoamericans, because how they processed it, they would get more niacin in their diet. It's not going to attribute to the cannibal part we're going to talk about here in a little bit. But we do know that any kind of heavy corn diet, regardless, you're getting very little niacin. So it's causing people to go crazy. So these hamsters essentially go berserk. And I was reading one guy that wrote an article about this, and he's like, how this whole incident that happened in Europe hasn't been looped into zombie folklore was beyond him. He was like, there were different parts of time where people would talk about people eat each other going crazy. And he was like, maybe it was the corn. Maybe it was the corn making people go crazy because they weren't getting niacin in their diets. Now, obviously, I read a part here that, you know, the Mesoamericans were, some of them were processing the corn differently, so it was allowing for that B3 to get in their bodies. But that's not indicative of all tribes and how they were all processing it. So how were the Anasazi processing it? And we know that very similar. I mean, I thought this was super interesting that the hamsters' mothers were bringing the pups, putting it in the corn, and then eating them with the corn. And it really made me think about the Anasazi and what they were doing with the corn as well. They were doing the same thing. They were mixing human flesh in with the corn.
I mean, where to begin? So yeah, that process of breaking down the corn and for consumption is what I was referring to earlier. I wish I saved that article, but about how the Maya would break it down and basically be able to eat it without going into full-blown chaos mode. Okay. I have a picture of it. I'll send it to you so you can throw it up on the screen. I just found the picture. So I'll send that to you. But the Maya were, the Maya sort of predated the Aztecs. So the Aztecs would have descended more or less from the Maya. And that does not mean that the Aztecs took the Mayans everything. You know, they may not have been practicing the same process of breaking down the corn that the Maya were. Also, I think it's really important to realize that at least the Aztecs, there are certain other tribes like the Tonkawa. I don't know about the Anasazi. Nobody really does. Some other tribes that eat people on or ate people on sort of like a random widespread sort of in sort of like a widespread way. But the Aztecs, it seemed they mainly ate their enemies. They ate like in war, they ate their prisoners, and they ate for religious reasons. And that makes me believe that there was probably a certain sect of people within the Aztec Empire that did eat corn for the purpose of becoming cannibalistic. Mm. I think those would be your medicine men and women. I think those could be your god kings. I think those are the people who are most maniacal in battle. You know, proponents of the dietary-based hypothesis that you were talking about earlier, they argue that inadvertently cannibalism might have actually helped correct the niacin deficiency, and that would stabilize their behavior. And what that would basically do is create sort of this actual bloodlust where cannibalism is necessary to sustain certain people in the population. And that sort of I mean, that adds a whole nother element to magic and sorcery and communication with the gods, what they were actually capable of. And then when you talk about the Anasazi and you see how heavily they were in to communicating with the sky gods and not only communicating with them, but actually bringing them to the planet somehow, to the surface in their sort of cannibalistic ceremonies, they're the same trait. And so in the end, if the Anasazi did end up cannibalizing themselves to oblivion and they ate themselves to death because of some sort of maybe attack from the giants or something like that, they were forced into it or did it ritualistically, who knows? But not only were they mixing the corn in with the flesh, they were also cracking the skulls open and using them as bowls, which is evidenced by the burn marks that were found on the Anasazi skulls. So whatever was being done often and regularly, and they knew how to do it pretty well. Like the cannibalism from the Anasazi definitely seemed to be a little bit beyond the ritual activity of the Aztecs. It's almost like the Anasazi were worse than the Aztecs when it came to the cannibalism. And who knows why that really is, but I like to believe that it was mostly to appease the gods. You know, that's kind of how I believe. I believe that they probably were killing themselves off through processes like not being able to feed their massive population, sickness spreading because of disease and filth not being properly, like sewage not being properly drained away from the villages, rotting food, stuff like that, not knowing where to bury the dead. And then gradually it became this sort of return to cannibalism that ended them in the end. That's kind of how I envision it.
No, I like it. And the more I was digging through a lot of this stuff with the Anasazi I was looking at different types of basically corn meals. So they've got pozole, which is a stew made of maize kernels. Now, I know that some people want to say that pozole is the dish where they're mixing in the human flesh. It's actually not, though. It's tlatcatlegoli is the name of the dish where they would take dried maize and then they would make a sacrifice. And you were just talking about these witch doctors, these elites, right? And they would take the heart out of people that they had conquered or captured. And then they would take the heart and mix it in with the maize and it would create this dish. Now, pozole is what, I'm going to try to say this the best way possible, uneducated people would say that pozole would be the man corn, would be the corn dish. It's actually not. It's tlatcatlegoli would be the dish where they would mix this human flesh in with this corn, which, look at it this way. If we go back to the hamsters and they're eating this large amount of corn, it's causing them to go crazy because they're not getting the niacin and they're literally taking the pups and they're putting it in the corn and eating it with the corn. It could be very similar to the Anasazi because if they weren't processing this corn the same way, they would be mixing it in, not just for ritual consumption, but also to eat. And I just reading through man corn, they suggested several reasons why the Anasazi would have been eating people. It wasn't just one particular reason. Now, granted, they all pushed towards that a lot of it was religious with them, and it was all based in some sort of sacrifice to the gods, but they weren't just eating a little bit. And I've heard this from people who are apologetics towards cannibalism in some Native American tribes. The problem is when you look at what these archaeologists have uncovered, they are finding full-on skeletal remains that have been cleaned and eaten, that they were eating full human bodies. It's not just a little bit. So they were eating it as full-on consumption as a dietary part of what they ate day to day, which I know that's controversial, but there's a lot, and I'm going to show a little bit here in a minute from the book, but there's a lot of evidence for that. And you've got guys who have been boots on the ground, legitimate archaeologists and paleontologists who have looked at these bones and understand what they are. And there is just an inordinate amount of bones that were found that lets you know that this wasn't just some, oh yeah, we took the heart out every now and then. We, you know, sprinkled a little bit of heart juice on the corn and we ate that. No, they were eating people full on, just like you would, you know, eat a deer and use most of it.
Well, and that's one of the main reasons that so many tribes warred among each other. Like there's a long history of these North American tribes accusing each other of cannibalism. And, you know, because you got to figure if that is the case and they were eating these people like that regularly. And some of the stuff I was seeing was they weren't just eating their bodies like on this, like the flesh. They were actually cracking open the bones and pouring out the marrow. Like they were getting everything they could out of these people. And I mean, you have to sustain that somehow. It seems kind of counterproductive to eat your own people. So you would have to probably go throughout the land and kidnap people, abduct people, and that would most likely be your meal, which is, of course, going to completely disrupt societies wherever a cannibalistic culture is.
Absolutely, man. And I definitely want to shift gears into this man corn part and talk about Christy Turner and what he and his wife had discovered. And just so people know, he was an American anthropologist known for his research on dental anthropology and taphonomy, which, by the way, taphonomy is derived from the Greek word taphos, meaning burial. It examines the transformations that occur to an organism's remains from death to the moment they're preserved as a fossil. And it's the study of the process that affect animal and plant remains after death and before they become fossilized. So they know by looking at these fossils, everything that happened to that body and what caused it. And this is their particular field of research. We're not talking about some charlatans or some people who don't know what they're talking about. These are legitimate scientists. This is what they do. And they decided to go to this area where the Anasazi tribes in the Southwest of America and showcase what these bones really were. And they did it in an inordinate amount of research on it. And I found it absolutely fascinating. And he talks about that the Southwest has been inhabited by humans for at least 11,000 years, most of that time by closely related but sub-regionally separated nomadic hunters and gatherers. By the beginning of the Common Era, three main regionally distinctive archaeological cultures, Anasazi, the Hohokam, and the Magalahad, evolved, and the people of each were growing maize in addition to hunting and gathering. So he talks about you've got these three groups there during this period of time, and his whole point of research is to understand the cannibal part of this, because there were so many people coming out that were refuting what previous archaeologists had already said about what was going on in this area. And they decided to go in there, take a look at these bones, and show that here's scientific evidence that all of these bones in this Justice Anasazi area were eaten. These people were eaten, and this is why these bones were left here. It wasn't for any other reason but cannibalism. And I thought that that was super interesting, at the same time disturbing, if that makes sense. And I know that it was a monumental task for someone to take on, especially because they were getting so much pushback for even attempting to do this. And even when they wrote the book, so many people came out and they were against it. And they were, just like you said earlier, white man bad, right? It's always the white man. It's never just people are evil, right? And I'm not negating what the white man did. Let's not throw that out there. We're just as bad. But
I saw an interview with him and he was like, dude, it's not like I want this to be true. It's just the evidence that I'm seeing. I gain nothing by this being true. It's just, it appears to be.
Exactly. And the Tlatlakali, the man corn, is a sacred meal of sacrificed human meat cooked with corn. So that is the legitimate definition of it, and I just talked about it earlier, but this is the basis of the entire book, is understanding why that these Anasazi were attacking all of these other tribes and eating them. And the Hopi talk about them consistently as being a very violent, violent tribe of people. And all of the other tribes in that area were pretty scared of them, from all indications.
Yeah, it would be interesting. I know some of their descendants went and tried to live like some of the Pueblan cliff dwellers and whatnot. It would be interesting to see like what kind of conflicts those people were having with the Anasazi, because I'm pretty sure they were probably, I don't think that all like Hopi and Pueblan people are descendants of Anasazi. So I would wonder if there was some pretty intense activity going on in the canyons back then too, even between them. Because they're one of the ones that's still around, the tribes that's still around in pretty good numbers. And they do have some stories about how the Anasazi were like demons on the land. Like they were demonic entities, and to sometimes even go, like to this day, even to just go to the locations of their ruins and whatnot is bad juju for you. Yeah, I mean, I heard about that a number of times. There's actually, I was just studying one. There's a window. There's a window in one of these great houses that they built. And they believe that if you just look through the window, you could literally perhaps be teleported to another dimension. So if that's the actual fear that these other tribes have of the Anasazi, it wouldn't surprise me at all that these guys were absolutely probably religious nut jobs who were, you know, cannibalizing the tribes.
You know, absolutely. And to that point of the signatures of cannibalism, and I talked about this at the beginning of the episode, and I just want to give credence to all the work that was done on this book and show that this isn't just some, you know, half put together conspiracy theory book. This is legitimate research. And these are the taphonomic signatures of cannibalism. And I'm going to go through all of them because I think it's very important for people to hear it. Number one, a single short-term depositional episode can be discerned from a stratigraphy and bone quality. Interment in the desert and plateau environment has to be rapid to prevent bone weathering and animal scavenging. Number two, bone preservation is good to excellent. Unmodified formal burials often have poor bone preservation, suggesting that soft tissue decay processes are absent in cannibalism. Number three, total whole bone and bone fragment count ranges between 400 and 3,500 elements in a given episode. Body reconstruction shows a high rate of unaccounted for bone element loss. Number four, most body segments are disarticulated. Number five, vertebrae are usually missing. Number six, massive breakage occurs in 4 to 100% of the skeletal elements. Number seven, breakage is by percussion hammering against some form of anvil with spiral and compression fracturing very common. So obviously they're whacking these people before they're eating them.
Whacking and yanking.
Yes. Number eight, head, face, and long bone breakage is almost universal. Number nine, burning after butchering and breaking is evident in 2 to 35% of all elements. Butchering and skinning cut marks occur in 1 to 5% of all whole and fragmentary elements, and usually in appropriate locations for muscle tissue or scalp removal. 11, animal gnawing and chewing occurs only in a small portion of all elements, usually less than 5%. Some gnawing may have been done by humans and or their dogs. So this is after the fact, eating, and then you got your dog gnawing on the remains.
One big happy family.
Big happy family. Hey, I'm sure the dogs are happy.
Yeah.
Number 12, bone and body reconstruction shows that the damage sequence was mainly cutting, breaking, and burning, or if evident, gnawing. So these are all evidence of eating a person when you're looking at this evidence of the bones. Pseudo tools or accidentals made of human bone may occur in the frequency range of 1 to 10,000 pieces. 14, the frequency of human and other alteration in cannibalized bone lots is 95% for breakage, 20% for burning, 3% for cut marks, and 2% for possible gnawing or chewing. So those are the 14 descriptors for what they look for when they go in to look at these skeletal remains to say, this is evidence of these skeletons and they were eaten as human beings. So again, these guys are not just haphazardly running around just saying, oh yeah, they ate all these people without any evidence. No, there's a ton of evidence in this book. And there's a ton of pictures in this book too of actual bones, and they show you how that these bones are animal bones and they're not cannibalized. These are human remains. These are not cannibalized. They go through all that in the book, and then they show you the ones that are. So they show you the juxtaposition between all these different kinds to show you that, yes, these Anasazi were eating people and they were mixing it with the corn john. That's the part that's super fascinating to me. And when I ran across the bizarre story of the hamsters, it's even crazier. They're doing the same thing. They were taking their pups and putting it in the corn, then eating it. So what is it about the corn that was causing their minds to break? And we have to think that that's some part of not just the ritual purposes, but there had to be something else going on chemically within the brain to cause that.
Yeah. And the question of whether we lost the ability to properly consume that corn over time, or whether we were never supposed to consume corn in the first place, will probably always be the question, right? Like, who knows? Like, were we ever supposed to consume corn? I mean, to me, that is the big question is, and when I say corn, I mean this maize. Like, was this maize actually supposed to be consumed by us, or were we? Is it kind of like the way that people look at the octopus, where it's just kind of like, that's, we don't even know what the octopus is. It probably shouldn't even be here on Earth. Is corn kind of like that of the plant world where, you know, unbeknownst to us, this is an alien, you know, like, because corn is a very interesting plant too. I mean, it's like a lot of plants. It can mate with itself. It can fully grow itself. It doesn't need another plant to help it go. And it cannibalizes itself as it grows. It makes room for the fruit, the corn, the cob, essentially. And the strongest one's always at the top, and they get weaker as you go down the stalk, and the stalk dies as the corn matures. And that's generally how fruits and vegetables work. But it's an interesting idea when you couple that with the fact that most of the gods who were giving the ancient peoples maize, with the, you know, not counting Quetzalcoatl, but a lot of the other ones, were deeply integrated with fertility too. Mm. And then you tie that with what the Watchers were doing to mankind. So now your fertility gods and goddesses across all these, you know, South American cultures and whatnot are bringing corn. They want you to eat the corn. They also want you to reproduce. They want you to do all these things so that you can create a sustainable ecosystem for the Nephilim to consume or something like that. Like, I don't know, dude. like where do you let your imagination stop, you know? But when you
dude, we did an episode about fallen angel Nephilim corn man. This is probably gonna get 5 views, bro. Like
or 5 million, dude. Who knows? But I mean, dude, like when you look at the Anasazi people, they're the ones who built Mesa Verde, dude. They're the ones who built Chaco, like the great kivas in Chaco Canyon and all that kind of stuff. Like, they left behind the greatest archaeological record in the United States. And it just also so happens to be that they were wildly cannibalistic, and we have no idea why, but somehow they were still able to have the most prominent civilization that we still have record of in North America. And that in of itself is like a really strange question, because when you look at these other cannibalistic tribes that are still in like the Amazon and stuff, I'm serious. Like, these tribes, they're typically like 30 to 50 people, and that's it. And like, they're not building. They're not building anything like this stuff. So these people, despite being cannibalistic, were somehow wildly intelligent and also very powerful in general, just to be able to build these kivas. A lot of the wood that they used in these kivas didn't even come from their area. They had to haul it in. So like, that's a whole lot of questions too. Like, I've been led to believe that cannibalism makes you weak. It makes you sick. It complicates your life, but it doesn't seem to be the case with the Anasazi. That's strange, you know?
Yeah. And their mysterious disappearance is also strange too. And you said something interesting. You said that the Anasazi are super documented, but we still don't know a lot about them, which mm-hmm. is also interesting. So we have all these pieces, all these things, but we don't know the root of it all. We right. don't really know a lot. And I think that's why we're just, you know, stabbing in the dark about what some of this stuff could be. But I think we put together at least something from a theoretical standpoint that's compelling for people when you're looking at the origins of corn. You know, we talked today about some of the apocryphal text and the genetic manipulation of plant life as far back as the dawn of time. you know, we talked about how that could be indicative of what was going on in the Americas too, with the Anasazi and the Aztecs and the Mayans, all of that, and how it's connected to the gods of old, which I believe that the gods of old are still around. So, you know, it's just rebranding. You know, now they're rebranding more into something a little more sci-fi than they did back then.
Yeah, and also just a closing note, because I think it's important and it's deeply ingrained with almost all of my research, but the Anasazi, we have found cliff paintings of six-fingered hands as well as spirals from the Anasazi. So you can, I mean, that's probably not just them making it up and painting it on the wall. So it, I mean, in my opinion, they were definitely in contact with giants or the Nephilim in one way, whatever you want to call them. I call them Nephilim, but a lot of people hate that word. So there was something superhuman among the Anasazi, and it was probably Nephilim influence that drove them to that.
Absolutely, man. Well, thanks for coming on, John. And speaking of six fingers, we've got a crazy documentary about to shoot here in about a month and a half. Y'all get ready for that. We've got absolute bombardment of films coming out over the next 2 years, and they're all being worked on behind the scenes. So we've got one coming out here in a couple months, The Meadow Project, which I had a blast doing that. Then later this fall or early fall, we've got Crowley's Melonheads, Children of the Beast, which is going to be another phenomenal one. Obviously, the one we're about to shoot, Beast of Bray Road. We've got tons of connections with a lot of six-finger type things. That's all I'm going to say. And it's going to be a lot of fun when everyone gets to see it. And if you can, John, let everybody know where to find you on the way out.
Yeah, you can look up 21CD. It stands for 21st Century Dystopian. My website is 21CDstudios.com, but you can also just search the 21CD podcast on YouTube, Spotify, or any podcast platform. I'm very video heavy, so my main platforms are YouTube and Spotify at the current time. So definitely try to catch the visuals if you can, but it's not required. Had a great time, Joel. It's always a pleasure hanging out with you. We have some crazy conversations, man.
Yeah, man.
And this one takes the cake, though. I've never talked this long about corn with ever.
Yeah, I think I'm going to call this episode Nephilim Corn, too. I think that's what we're going to call it.
I'm
going to
go make some cornbread. That's what I'm going to do. With some yellow corn.
Oh, for sure, man. And just so everybody knows, for me, John's got a great product over there at 21CD Podcast. His visuals are absolutely gorgeous. He's got a great editing style. You guys go check it out on YouTube or Spotify, like he said. But, you know, if you're an Apple Podcast purist, you can still listen to him over there, too. Yep. So definitely check him out. On the way out, check out my new single, Spinning. And you know what it is, guys. Go outside, touch grass, and get your tail out the hole.
Sometimes I feel alone when I'm looking at myself, cause I look down a road full of bottles, broken nails. So I just try to call, swerving off the road. I used to do it for the roses, adulation, so they notice. Used to say they weren't my focus, lying, jonesing for the Joneses things. I know that everything that's going on can start to overwhelm, like the war on terror is just a war within ourselves. Are you woke or are you awake? Genuine or are you fake? I'm feeling like I'm sent by UPS with all the tape. These boxes are all made by delusions that we chase, but I'm just staying base. Snakes are slithering, they keep it snake. She coming with the cake, but how is bait? Is important, but so is what you bring. Cause being real ain't acting like a king. I feel I'm spinning round and about to crash. Chaos all around me, feeling trapped. All this pressure mounts, I wanna crack. Like I'm going around in circles. Like I'm going around in circles. Like I'm going around, like I'm going around. Like I'm going around in circles. Look at leashes on the collars of these people. Follow monsters like a Mogwai in the water, then they multiply. It's easy to get bitter. I'd rather dulcify. I'd rather justify anything but selling me. Leave me alone with the mic like a spelling bee. Smoking guns in your face, but
but you disagree. I ain't had to change your mind, I'm just hoping that you'll listen. I'm just hoping that a little bit of what I'm saying will make you take a second and see that everything ain't adding up. I know it's hard, I know it's hard. I feel I'm spinning round and about to crash. Chaos all around me, feeling trapped. All this pressure mounts, I wanna crack. Like I'm going around.